With coal in decline, workers are looking to other industries, like solar.
I just found this job, and it was about the same pay rate that I was making before, so I just went for it. Ended up really liking it.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, we look at new opportunities for miners in renewable energy. Plus, more traditional environmental jobs are also paying off in coal country. And using data collected over years of spring bird migrations.
It's sort of a bit like fishing in a way. We put out our nets to see what we catch.
A local researcher finds that some birds are making babies earlier. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. President Trump has pledged to bring back jobs in heavy industry, especially coal mining. That message helped him gain support in big fossil fuel states. But jobs in coal, even in Pennsylvania, are quickly being eclipsed by another source of energy, solar. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports the solar industry's boom could complicate the question of which jobs the country should prioritize and protect.
At CONSOL Energy's Harvey Mine, about an hour south of Pittsburgh, Craig Williams takes a midday break above ground in a big room at the mine's entrance. He's in a hard hat and he's wearing a dusty yellow-striped mining jacket. Though times have been tough in the coal industry, Williams and other miners here have managed to keep their jobs. He hopes to hang on to his job as a foreman.
You know, Pittsburgh used to be a big on steel. That's mostly gone now. We're one of the last, you know, industries around, and hope to keep it that way.
A father of two, he says, like generations before him, coal is the best way he's able to support his family. Williams wouldn't say how much he's making, but nationwide, coal miners make around $80,000 a year.
If you had to take another job in this area especially, you're going to take anywhere from a 50 to a 70% pay cut to what the next best thing is that's out there.
But 40% of coal mining jobs have disappeared since 2011, and now only 50,000 of these jobs remain. Experts say automation, lower demand for electricity, and above all, competition from cheaper fuels are what's killing the industry. Those fuels include natural gas from fracking and increasingly renewable energy. Solar power now accounts for just under 1.5% of electricity in the U.S. But according to the Department of Energy, solar jobs now outnumber those in coal by more than 2-to-1. So, can laid-off coal miners find jobs in solar?
Well, certainly it's a possibility, but there are a couple of major challenges.
Rob Godbee is an energy economist at the University of Wyoming. He says one of those challenges is simple: location.
When you are thinking about coal mining in Appalachia, I mean, oftentimes there are generations of families in those regions, and it's just very difficult to pick up and move.
And then there's pay. Coal miners make on average around $35 an hour, Godbee says, in part because the job can be so dangerous. In renewables, the pay is more like $20 or $25 an hour.
That doesn't mean you couldn't raise a family on that, but you're a lot closer to the average income in a lot of states in the solar industry than you are in mining industries.
On a rooftop at a community center in Millvale, just outside of Pittsburgh, a gang of seven workers in neon green t-shirts bolt down solar panels. The crew includes 23-year-old Wiley Kuntz, who worked at a coal mine, though as a lower-paid contractor. When he got laid off last year, he saw a job opening with Energy Independent Solutions, a local solar company.
I didn't like just mentally be like, I'm just going to completely switch. It just was a coincidence. I just found this job, and it was about the same pay rate that I was making before, so I just went for it, ended up really liking it.
One thing that did not weigh on his decision, climate change.
I don't really believe in the whole climate change thing or not. It's good, it takes the carbon, for sure. It's a lot less, and it's a lot cleaner energy.
But a steady paycheck, and not necessarily the environment, is what attracted him to the job. Kuntz says he likes the problem solving he gets to do in solar, and he could see himself staying in the industry. Brian Krenzelak was a roofer before joining the company 7.5 years ago.
Have these out.
Krenzelak installs solar and trains others, and he believes in the mission of green energy. His wife also works, and the couple have three kids, one in college with another about to enter. They even have a second home in Florida.
You know, I do well with this company, very well. It covers what we need to cover. I mean, I'm not becoming a millionaire overnight, but steadily have been building the nest egg for sure.
Experts say solar's boom is being helped by incentives that are scheduled to run out in a few years, and they don't know how long the surge in business will last. Some companies are reporting lower installations nationwide, but solar jobs in Pennsylvania grew last year by almost a quarter, and Krenzelak's company, Energy Independent Solutions, is busy. It's looking to basically double its workforce of 22 over the next year and a half.
We had to slow the salesmen down at a certain point. We were selling so much solar, we had to actually slow them down a little bit till we caught up.
Krenzelak likes the idea that his industry is up and coming. He says when his crew went on a big installation recently, other contractors were curious about what they do.
So there was iron workers there, carpenters, union laborers. Everyone's coming up to us.
He says it feels like solar is an industry of the future. And when he looks into the future, he likes what he sees. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
One way President Trump is trying to bring back coal jobs is by rolling back environmental regulations.
I have already eliminated a devastating anti-coal regulation.
Trump signed a measure overturning a Department of Interior stream protection rule, and he also pledged to turn the Environmental Protection Agency from a, quote, job killer to a job creator. But in parts of coal country, environmental regulations have actually created jobs. Ohio Valley Resources' Glynis Board has this story from West Virginia.
Hydrologist Ed Watson with the Canaan Valley Institute is in the business of fixing broken streams. And yes, it's a business. From the inside of his truck, Watson points to a hillside towering behind a shopping center in Logan County, West Virginia. His organization just finished restoring an entire watershed here. The project took 5 years.
So the watershed we're going into was mined pre-law, as they say.
What he means by pre-law is that this mountain was mined for coal before the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, which requires companies to try to reclaim land.
We all decided that we could actually do something and possibly put some streams back where streams haven't flowed for 50 or 60 years.
Watson studied old topographical maps and clues in the land to figure out where streams here used to flow.
Our thought process was to try to rehook up the plumbing of the watershed. I'm not sure exactly what we can see from right here.
He points at a reconstructed hillside, a really steep one, with a small stream built in, complete with rocks, woody debris, and native trees and shrubs planted alongside.
So we built a stream that is as though it has sorted itself out, but in year one instead of year 10,000.
Watson was hired to design this project by a land restoration company that buys property to see it permanently restored. That company, Ecosystem Investment Partners, owns about 13 similar properties across the country, 70,000 acres in all. About 2,000 of these restored properties exist in the U.S. Land restoration companies get credit from federal agencies based on restoration accomplishments.
So you come back after 5 years and somebody assesses what the ecological value is based on a certain scoring mechanism, and then that credit is a commodity that can be bought and sold.
And while Watson does this kind of work because he loves improving the environment, he also loves a paycheck, and so do the contractors hired to turn his designs into reality.
Our basic business is a construction business that specializes in rebuilding streams and wetlands.
Chris White co-founded a company called Appalachian Stream Restoration about 13 years ago.
So you talked about how like people think of you as environmentalists. Do you consider yourselves environmentalists?
Oh, I don't think so. I prefer to think of myself as a capitalist.
White grew up in what he calls hit-or-miss coal mining. He now employs about 30 people, many of them displaced miners. They travel all over the region fixing broken streams with backhoes and other heavy machinery. He has a $2 million payroll annually. And according to the National Mitigation Banking Association, the ecological restoration industry as a whole creates $25 billion each year.
It's a huge economy that requires specialized training, requires specialized people, and create high-paying jobs.
And it's all possible because of the environmental regulations established 40 years ago in the Clean Water Act. Section 404 requires any developer that impairs wetlands or streams to fix similar systems in the affected area. And while there's a lot of debate in scientific circles about stream mitigation and the science of restoration, as long as the Clean Water Act remains intact and land continues to be developed at the rate we see today, White and others restoring ecosystems expect to keep making bank, so to speak. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Glynis Board in Logan, West Virginia.
Ohio Valley Resource is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Researchers are asking themselves something like that when it comes to birds migrating to western Pennsylvania in the spring.
If they're migrating early and they're breeding early, are they breeding earlier because they're migrating early? Or are they breeding more quickly after they arrive?
Got it? Later on the Allegheny Front, we'll hear the answer. Spoiler alert, it's all because of climate change. Stay tuned. There's no doubt that changes are happening at the Environmental Protection Agency. As we heard earlier, Trump wants to refocus the agency to loosen regulations on industries. In fact, if you go to EPA's website, you'll see more than a few photographs of EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt with power plant workers in Missouri, promoting the administration's new Back to Basics agenda. Something else you might notice there, as the LA Times reported, climate change has been removed from the environmental topics menu on the site. Those are just the most recent examples of changes that are making many staff at EPA nervous and angry, including former staffer Michael Cox. He resigned from EPA recently after 4 years as climate change advisor in the Pacific Northwest and Alaska, and worked at the agency for decades before that. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier and I interviewed Cox for our Trump on Earth podcast, because on his way out the door, Cox wrote his boss a scathing letter. Here he is in his own words and some of our conversation.
March 31st, 2017. Dear Administrator Pruitt, today is my last day after working at EPA for over 25 years. I assume you are aware of the current low morale of EPA career staff. I have worked under six administrations with political appointees leading EPA from both parties. This is the first time I remember staff openly dismissing and mocking the environmental policies of an administration and, by extension, you, the individual selected to implement the policies. The message we are hearing is that this administration is working to dismantle EPA and its staff as quickly as possible.
So what happened? Why did you write this letter that has gained a little bit of national headlines?
Well, Reed, the letter was really trying to do two things. I've been working with EPA since 1987. As with any organization you work with, at least for myself, for a long time, you really want to see that organization succeed and meet its mission, which EPA's mission is pretty simple: protect human health and the environment. So what I had observed was low, very low staff morale, probably lowest since I'd been at the agency since 87. So what I wanted to do was to write a letter to Administrator Pruitt and just document some of the concerns that I had that I thought were contributing to the low morale. And then second, provide some ideas on how he might navigate the agency since he's new and try to engage staff and increase the morale. Because in my mind, in order to be successful, the EPA career staff have to be on board and inspired and motivated to do their work.
Yeah, you say that the staff are openly mocking the new administration's policies, decisions. You know, what are some of the main things that people there are upset about?
Well, a couple things. Let me start with the climate. Administrator Pruitt, over a month ago, talked about his thought that carbon dioxide from human activities was not a primary contributor to climate change. Now, he's modified that a bit, but that still concerned, I think, people at EPA because many people think that climate change is one of the biggest environmental challenges of our lifetime. And so that was a little disturbing. I think the second thing, which is kind of attached to the climate change, was the budget. Now, I understand, and many other people at EPA understand, that elections have consequences and that a new administration has different priorities. But the proposed budget that came out of the administration was cutting EPA's staff 20 to 25% and cutting and eliminating many programs. So that was disturbing in the sense that if you look at that, it's kind of cutting to the core of the work that we do. So I think that also contributed to some of the low morale. One thing that tipped me a little bit was, I think it was March 28th, where the president came to the EPA.
It is my high honor and distinct privilege to introduce to you my friend, the President of the United States of America, President Donald Trump.
And he was coming to sign executive orders that was rescinding or repealing many of the climate change activities that had been put forth by President Obama.
I guess they like what we're about to sign.
It wasn't a surprise he was going to do that. He had said he was going to do that.
I knew they were going to like this one.
But the day of when he was coming, the chief of staff for Administrator Pruitt sent out all staff to all of us, and the headline was, "Our Big Day Today." So for many of us, we looked at that and we're going, "Our Big Day? Who's the R here?" The president is coming to EPA, which obviously he's president, he can do that. But it just kind of set us all off and felt like a real poke in the eye to coming to EPA and saying we're going to repeal these. And not only that, but in some way we were supposed to be happy and proud of that.
With today's executive action, I am taking historic steps to lift the restrictions on American energy, to reverse government intrusion, and to cancel job-killing regulations.
And know exactly the day you're talking about, March 28th. That's where the president signs an executive order at the EPA, surrounded by coal miners.
Come on, fellas. Basically, you know what this says? You know what it says, right? You're going back to work. That's right.
Good.
You're going back to work.
I mean, I guess the implication is there was sort of an anti-industry agenda at EPA.
I think in terms of the coal miners, I can't speak for anybody else. For me, what was more disturbing was what I call false hope and sympathetic to the coal miners. You know, they are losing their jobs, and there's evidence is clear. The question that I have is not pitting the coal miners against anybody else, but just looking at historically what's happened with coal mining jobs. They've been declining for years, for decades, long before President Obama came into office, mainly because of automation. More recently, the decline in the production of coal was because of fracking, because of the cheap price of natural gas. And what was ironic to me is the other policies that President Trump is promoting is to have more drilling, to open up more lands for drilling. So the demand for natural gas, coal, for electrical generation is probably not going to go up very much. Yet we're going to have more supply of natural gas, which Economics 101 says other supplies like coal, which are more expensive, will probably suffer. So I was disturbed personally just because I think he was giving false hope to the miners that their jobs were going to come back.
If you were to sit down with Scott Pruitt and, you know, have a beer or have a cup of coffee, what would you want him to know, or what would you want him to do?
You know, it's a great question, Reed, and I'd gladly sit down and have a beer with him. You know, to be honest, I think he's probably a nice guy. I think he's got a good family, and I'm sure he's a nice guy. So nothing against Scott Pruitt. It's more wanting to give him some ideas on how he could navigate EPA. So I had four things I would tell him to do or suggest that he does. Is the first thing, when he came the EPA's first day or two, we had an all-staff meeting, and he was over the TV for us. And first thing he said is, I want to listen and learn from EPA career staff. And, you know, that's welcoming. We hope he does that. Up to this point, we hadn't seen much evidence of that. So do that. Listen and learn. The second, really use science as the cornerstone of the work we do and how we move forward. As I say, good science makes good policy. Let the science drive you. Obviously, there's the laws, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, that we have to, is a cornerstone too. So look at the law, but look at the science. Make the science your driver. The third, I think a leader really needs to be able to motivate and inspire staff. That's what gets them to go the extra mile. No matter what business you're in, government, industry, nonprofits, that's what a leader needs to do, inspire and motivate. So I would hope that Administrator Pruitt could advocate and support staff. In, let's say, for example, in the budget negotiations, I'm hoping he's in there saying, you know, we don't really think we can have these kind of cuts at EPA and still sustain and meet our mission of protecting human health and the environment. And the final one is, come and visit. Come out to the Northwest. Come out to Alaska. We'll show you around. We'll show you what we're doing, how we're working with states, how we're working with tribes. We'll take you to Alaska. You can see firsthand what climate change is doing to villages and communities in Alaska. So those are the four things I would suggest to Administrator Pruitt if we just did happen to sit down and have a beer or two.
That was Michael Cox, a former EPA scientist, talking with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier and me for our Trump on Earth podcast. We did reach out to EPA about his letter to Administrator Pruitt, but didn't hear back. You can read the full text of the letter at trumponearth.org. That's where you'll also find past episodes, and you can subscribe there too. We're doing the podcast in partnership with Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. Coming up on the Trump on Earth podcast, President Trump orders a review of the nation's public lands. Can he undo generations of protections?
I'm wishing I would have brought my Teddy Roosevelt and I could be quoting scripture from Roosevelt about the national significance. You got me riled up.
How the administration and Congress want to increase coal and natural gas development on federal lands. That's coming up on the Trump on Earth podcast. Listen at trumponearth.org. A new study shows that in order for some early birds to catch the worm, they have to breed sooner in the spring. To find out more, I visited Powder Mill Nature Reserve in Westmoreland County. It's owned by the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. The red bud trees are in bloom there in the Laurel Highlands, and Lute DeGroat is in the thick of spring migration. He's the avian research coordinator and runs the bird banding program at Powder Mill.
It's sort of a bit like fishing in a way. We put out our nets to see what we catch.
From early in the morning until about noon, he and a handful of volunteers patrol a series of nets, kind of like volleyball nets, that are set up around the property.
This is a red-winged blackbird. I'm going to grab him by the body and very carefully pull the netting over the tip of the wing
Birds like this little guy with a distinctive red patch on its wing get caught up in the fine netting and drop down into a pocket where they're scooped up by researchers.
The red-winged blackbirds tend to hold on tight.
He's really clinging on. When it's finally freed, DeGroat gingerly places the bird into a bag, like a small pillowcase, and loops its string into a red carabiner around his neck. Red indicates which size metal band to place on the blackbird's leg so it can be tracked.
I'm heading to 3. If anyone wants to check the edge of the ponds, that'd be great.
All the birds they capture this morning and every morning are taken back to a small lab where they're banded with a unique number and weighed. Researchers also examine their feathers to determine age and if the birds are getting ready to breed.
The females, when they're in breeding condition, will lose the feathers on the breast and insert some fluid to create really like a hot water bottle for the eggs.
And they've been collecting these data here at Powder Mill consistently for over 50 years. That's how they know from previous studies that birds are migrating here a little earlier in the spring than they used to and breeding sooner. And that got DeGroat and his research partner, Molly McDermott, thinking.
All right, if they're migrating early and they're breeding early, are they breeding earlier because they're migrating early? Or are they breeding more quickly after they arrive?
So what did you find?
Yeah, they're basically getting busier earlier after arrival.
That's true for the majority of the 17 common bird species they studied. In their recent paper published in the journal PLOS ONE, they connect early breeding to warmer springs and climate change. Because while birds are arriving in western Pennsylvania a day earlier for every 1 degree Celsius that the temperature has warmed over the last few decades, spring buds are opening 3 days earlier. Those plants and the insects birds rely on for food, for the survival of their young, are now sort of mismatched with the timing of spring migration. So these birds are responding the only way they can.
They're having to catch up because they're not able to catch up during migration. They're not able to sort of advance that as much as the plants. They have to begin breeding soon after arrival. If they want to breed at a time period, that's sort of what they're used to.
When the tender plants and insects they eat are at their peak. A quarter of the species which bred earlier in this study, like black-capped chickadees, were more productive, had more young in these warmer years. But another 25%, including hooded warblers, didn't. Their productivity declined. DeGroat says you can look at the results of this study two ways. On the glass half-full side, it shows some bird species are flexible and capable of adapting to climate change. But while weather isn't climate, a few years ago there was a hard winter and later spring, this year is warmer, the overall trend for birds is worrying.
If it continues to warm, that window which they have to be adaptable is shrinking.
This most recent study just looks at the timing of bird breeding, but DeGroat says it's easy to see the implications for the ecosystem. If some species are less successful because of climate change, there might be fewer birds to pick off insects or spread seeds from the fruits they eat. Next, DeGroat plans to look at how birds might be affected by another aspect of climate change, more frequent and intense weather events like snowstorms. There's more on the study and some great photos of birds by Powder Mill staff. The detail on the ruby-throated hummingbird is kind of amazing. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Andy Kubis produces our Trump on Earth podcast, more at TrumpOnEarth.org. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation.